Nat Metcalf here. I'm really proud to be an ambassador for Flyhawk, leading the way for netball and women's sport. Flyhawk design and make netball dresses, have netball kit, netball teamwear, and netballs, plus much, much more. Head to flyhawk.com now.
The Netball Show with Flyhawk, raising the bar for netball and women's sport.
It's a Netball Show with Flyhawk and confession time from the off. This interview was planned over a glass of lemonade in the early hours, one morning after a game at Birmingham 2022. So keep chasing those dreams, everybody. Paul Dring is the England netball team manager. Welcome to the Netball Show.
Hi, Andy. Yeah, thanks for having me on. It's nice to be here.
Do you remember much about those early mornings at Birmingham 2022?
As you said it, it's just all flooding back to me.
I wanted to get you on the podcast because you've recently celebrated your 100th international as Roses team manager. A lot of things have changed since you first started, haven't they?
Yes.
Let's have a look at the role itself. I mean, obviously there for players on major tournaments, but do you look after room bookings, that kind of thing as well? As part of your role?
Yeah, everything really, I suppose, in the background. Where do I start? It starts really with kind of, if you look at the year now, we're already looking ahead to next year in terms of what our international calendar looks like. So once we've got that in place, then I kind of go ahead and just make everything possible, really, I suppose, in terms of just all of the flights, the hotels, the court bookings, all of that, you know, for all of our camps and all of our tours. That's just a very small part, though. I mean, that's, you know, it's a big part, but that's just one part, I suppose, of what you do as a job. But there's so many other parts to it as well. It starts off with, I suppose, getting everything in place in terms of what we need, with just simply to be in the right place to get ourselves over on tour. But then it's also creating the right environment. So we've kind of learned what works best for us as a group. So it isn't as simple as just booking a hotel and a netball court. It's trying to find the right hotel, the right area, the right kind of setup that will work for us. You know, things like the World Cup, for example, we put quite a lot of work into that. We went to the hotel, I recorded the hotel. We also went out there for the January Quad Series and we looked at what kind of worked for us as options and found out that not just getting hotel rooms, but by getting most of the floor and working with the hotel on that, that we could create our own little environment that spilt out onto the corridors and we could have posters up and we could kind of make it a home from home, if you like. So things like that probably don't get seen, but they're quite important parts to our environments, to getting the right sort of team room, the right breakout spaces, all of those kind of things that just make it a little bit more enjoyable when you're in a place for a long period of time. So I think, you know, that's one part, but then there's so many other bits. You know, I kind of deal with all the kit as well. So making sure that the players and staff have all the right kit. We do a lot with obviously getting all the players, the selection of players. I mean, although I don't get involved in the selection itself, but I do, once we do selection, it's kind of informing all the players and then getting everything in place in terms of, you know, letting everyone know everything they need to know for a tour. And then, yeah, just all the general stuff that you say around a tour, just supporting athletes and staff in getting there, packing all the right stuff, getting there and back, and all the transport and all the other bits that go alongside the tour. I mean, it's a huge team effort, though, really. There's so many other things that go into it, like all the nutrition as well. So I always kind of think, if you think about going on holiday, you probably just book a holiday where you book a flight and some accommodation and you kind of work it out as you go along. And that's maybe for a small group. Whereas doing this for a team, you're booking your flights, your accommodation for 30 people probably. But then also not just that, but like literally everything that you're going to do for every hour of every day that you're away to the finest detail, you know, in terms of all the timings, making sure that you're at training on time, at matches on time, dealing with all the traffic, all of the lunches and dinners and making sure that's catered for, plus it's nutritionally the right food, getting all your snacks and stuff in as well in between. So there's just, there's so many little parts as well that need to be done. It isn't just as simple as booking a holiday. It's a lot more complicated than that.
And two initial questions that come from that. Players and sharing rooms, is that up to the individual players themselves?
Yeah, we do. It's a bit of both, really. So I would normally work with the leadership group on that. So I would go to them and say, right, obviously, we know this is the group of players coming on tour. Can you recommend who shares with who? And they'll come back with a list to me. And for each place, if there's kind of the same people sharing all the time, I might challenge it and go back and say, oh, can we mix it up a little bit? It will kind of be a bit of a joint venture really between me and the leadership group just to get that right, because we want athletes to feel comfortable with the person they're sharing with, because obviously people have different sleeping patterns and different patterns and things, but it's also about trying to get the group integrated and not just being completely familiar with the same person all the time. You know, you get to know people better if you're sharing a room with them, don't you? So it's a bit of a joint venture, and the coaches have some input as well.
In Liverpool as well, we saw the Diamonds get a bus to the arena that was yards away. I mean, what would be your thoughts on that?
It's a very personal preference, really. I think we like to have control over what we're doing as much as we can. So I think where we can drive ourselves on tour and at home, we will do that. Because if you have a coach and you're obviously relying on a coach person being on time, picking you up and dropping you off, and if you finish the session early, then you might need to leave early and the coach might not be ready. So where we can, we try and provide our own transport. So we normally have like minivans where we can get like eight to 12 people in at a time. So we would do that. It isn't always practical with parking though. So there are other considerations. I would say where it's like things like the World Cup, where they provide transport for all the teams and it runs quite smoothly. It's quite nice for me for a change, not having to worry about getting all the vans out. And it's one less stress, I suppose, in some ways. But it does take away that element of control, because if you do need to move things, the bus might not be available. Whereas if you've got your own transport, then you can kind of flex a lot easier. You know, you're not relying on bus timetables. So obviously a preference would always be as close as possible. Recently at Nations Cup at Wembley, we stayed in the Hilton across the road and you can literally walk across the road. So that was perfect for us. You know, timings wise, you don't have to worry about any traffic or any of that kind of stuff. So I'd say it's a personal preference, but also budgets will play a part. You know, to have a coach drive you a 5-minute journey is quite expensive. So we would try and avoid that where we can. But obviously if it's provided, then that's one of the things that will go with the tournament. There's a few things. Personal preference and budget, I suppose, would be the things I'd consider.
You graduated from the Uni of Brighton in 1996 and you had a degree in sports science. So how many opportunities were there to work within high performance sport at that time?
First of all, you're giving away my age a little bit there, aren't you? I always try and kick that in a little bit. it's fine. As you've said, that was back in the day. So came out with a sports science degree in 1996 and there was no lottery funding at that stage. So the kind of UK sport model and the Olympic models that you've got and the sporting infrastructure that's there now wasn't there. So the normal thing for most people who came out at the same time as me is they kind of either went into teaching or became a fitness instructor, which is kind of what I did for a few years in a gym. There just weren't the jobs in sport, you know, so I kind of had to wait my time for that to come up and kind of drifted away from sport, really, as most people kind of my era did, really. You know, if I look at the people I went to uni with, there's probably only one out of the class that I know who's actually working in sport now. The rest have all kind of gone into other jobs or different careers because there just weren't those opportunities like there are now.
UCAS is still very important today, isn't it? So how did you enjoy your time there?
That was an interesting one as well. It's down the road from me. So I live in Worcester and UCAS is in Cheltenham. So I'd come back from travelling actually and I needed a job and that was something that ticked the boxes and sort of fitted what I had at the time, which I'd done a lot of kind of project management and kind of communications management type stuff. So it was a job in communications, actually. So definitely has helped me out going forward in terms of the job I do now, in terms of how you communicate with people. But it was good fun. Yeah, it got me used to being in an office environment, which is a million miles away from, I guess, the kind of world I'm in now. But it was a good job at the time. Enjoyed it.
These aren't from your wiki page either. This is proper research. 2014 Paralympic podium road coach with the GB cycling team. It's not netball just yet, but tell me a little bit about what you did.
Yeah, and that was my big break, I guess, in sport. So because I hadn't, as we already alluded to, because I came out with a sports science degree and didn't work in sport, I desperately wanted to work in sport. And in the background, I've always been a cyclist. That's kind of my sport, really. So I competed at quite a decent level, really, back in the late 90s in particular, and still race now. You know, it's one of those sports that you can kind of race in age groups. So I've always had a real love and passion for cycling and was always looking for opportunities. And one came up to work with Great Britain Para Cycling Team as a coach, just because I kind of had quite a lot of good experience of racing and had done a bit of coaching along the way. So kind of grabbed that with both hands. I couldn't actually quite believe it when they offered me the job. It was one of the most amazing days of my life, because
yeah.
I kind of knew that was going to be the start of something quite special. And as much as I enjoyed my job at UCAS, I didn't really want to work in communications in an office. I wanted to work in sport. And that was very special when I got offered that job. But it was incredible. I really enjoyed it. I went to work all over Europe, basically, traveling to races with the team and coaching. But I think one of the key things that we had, because we had quite a small staffing team and a lower budget, is that I kind of did a lot of team management as well. So we didn't even have a team manager for like 6 months of the job. So I kind of took on a lot of organizing, not just coaching it, but organizing the tours and trips away and getting us halfway across Europe and stuff in vans and whatever. So I kind of got used to a lot of logistics and management of groups of players, athletes at that stage. So yeah, it set me up quite nicely, really. Although I would say you could argue it's a million miles away from netball. I think it was a really good grounding in terms of working with groups of athletes, but also having been a coach, I kind of came into netball understanding it from a coaching perspective, which I think is really important, because there were times when I was at cycling that we had a team manager come in and kind of try and almost run the show a little bit too much. And I kind of thought, I learned from that actually when you're a coach, you're going to be leading this. It isn't going to be led by the team manager. So I kind of knew
the sign almost, yeah.
Yeah, and I think it was really important for me. So when I came into netball, I kind of thought, right, it isn't me as a team manager to lead this environment. It's to listen to what the coaches want and how they want to work this, how they want this environment to be, and to do what I can to support that as much as possible. So, I think it was a really good sort of stepping stone, if you like.
It sounds like Jess or Sonia were trying to get me on a DM, so if they can just hold off a second. The 2016 then was your move into England netball. Did you know much about the sport at the time of joining?
No, so I'm quite happy to admit that I knew nothing about netball at all. I mean, my only experience of netball in 2016 when I came into the role was thinking back to school days and the girls playing netball and the boys playing football. You know, that was my only knowledge. I hadn't had any sort of grounding in netball at all. I hadn't played it. I didn't know the rules. I'm quite happy to admit all this. It's all very true. Knew nothing. It was just completely new to me. Obviously did quite a bit of research before the interview and found out a little bit about the team. But yeah, I mean, I'm quite happy to, there were quite some quite funny stories. I mean, the first tour I actually did, I'll never forget this, because I'd just seen names. I didn't know who the players were and I didn't know how big the players were. And I remember standing up in front of everyone after lunch, I think it was on one day, and I had to go and pick up Jeeva from the airport. And I remember saying to everyone, right, I've got to go. I've got to go and pick up Geva from the airport. And everybody just absolutely just tore into me and started laughing. And I was like, what are you talking about? And they said, it's Jeeva. And that's the truth. I didn't know. And I've told Jeeva this story myself. I mean, I didn't know that was how you pronounce the name. So I knew so little about the sport. Netball welcomed me in with open arms, like from day one. I think it was unusual. Had some kind of comments to me. I remember one quite high profile coach actually saying to me, oh, you're the male team manager, are you? And I found that I took a bit of a step back. I was like, that's quite an interesting perspective. And it was different. I was coming into a sport that I knew nothing about, but also I didn't realize at the time I was coming in quite a unique position in international netball. But I was welcomed in with open arms, and I'll never forget that. England netball itself, the staff, the players, everybody just seemed to welcome me on board from day one. Once you get into the environment and you become familiar with everyone and are happy, then I like to think you create that nicer environment for other people to come into. So I think, I'm very proud of what we've created as an environment over the years. And I do think it's a welcoming, nurturing environment for people to come into.
Yeah, very much so.
Hi, I'm Jeeva Mentor, and you're listening to The Netball Show.
It's a netball show with Flyhook, and we're speaking to England netball team manager Paul Dring. Paul, how often are you able to look back and reflect on the England have done it, England have done it, I simply have no words commentary from Caroline and Sarah?
If I can't say this to Jess, because apparently I talk about it too much. But I do live in the past a little bit about that. I mean, it's hard not to reflect on it. I mean, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind it was the greatest moment of my life, you know, not just career, but of my life, like being involved in that and being there on the Gold Coast when we won. I mean, it was, I mean, we went into that tournament with a belief that we could do something quite special in this tournament. You know, who knows, we could win this thing. I don't think anybody else probably believed that outside of the team, maybe. But it was something that built as we went through that tournament. And we all just had such a great time, like the whole experience, you know, like I'm going to say it was about 5 weeks that we were away. From the first couple of games were quite interesting, but once we kind of got into the tour, it everybody just loved being there and just loved being in that environment. And we just excelled in that environment. And I think the culmination of that weekend, I'll just never forget thinking about that weekend and kind of saying back to people at home, like, this is the biggest weekend of my life. Like, this, there's something quite big could happen here. And knowing that we were going into that semi-final and yeah, then to win the final was just, yeah, beyond your wildest dreams, really. I mean, just to be there in the final was one thing, but then to win it and in the way that we did it was just kind of crazy. And I mean, I remember after the semi-final, we kind of went back and had a staff meeting that night. And at the end of the staff meeting, we kind of watched back the footage of the kind of celebrations. And we all kind of looked at each other and went, we're absolute loons the way we celebrate against Jamaica. Like, I can't believe that. And then, you know, it's just one of those things you don't have a script. But I remember sitting around talking about it. And then the next day, we do the same kind of thing happens, and then in the same sort of style, we win again. And the celebrations are even more wild. You know, you just can't prepare for anything like that, or just know how you're going to react in that moment. But it was, yeah, it was incredibly special. And it was just really nice as well to see not just what it meant to everybody, you know, the players and how much work they put in, but that was one thing. But then when we came home and to get the reaction that we had, and you know, there is a reality, you do live in a bubble, you know, it's a cliche that everyone says, but you don't quite realise the impact that it's having at home until you get back. And, you know, I think it was on the flight on the way home that it really dawned on me what had happened, because I was starting to get messages. I was on the Wi-Fi on the flight and I was starting to get messages from our comms team with this requests for the girls when they came back. You know, the one show breakfast, the BAFTAs,
I think, wasn't it, as well, and things like that. And
well, literally every show you could think of, yeah, we're just getting in touch. And I remember we got to Abu Dhabi Airport, and I think only six of the girls had come back because the other six were out in Australia. And I remember kind of getting them around and saying, I need to ask you about this before we get on the next flight. But we've had a few requests come in. And normally that's quite a hard thing to ask, because you're thinking, oh, I'm just going to get off a flight. They're going to want to go home, see friends and family. And I said, look, these requests have come in and we need to kind of move on these quite quickly. And every single one of them was like, I want to do it. I'll do it. And it was like all six of them were then the next day were just going straight off to BBC and whatever. And it was
fantastic.
It was incredible. Yeah. And it was incredible then to watch them all and see how much that was celebrated when we got back and how much it had changed, you know, not just netball, but British sport as well. And that was really special.
What about things like Netball World Cup in Liverpool, Birmingham 2022? Anything in particular that you take from those events?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult, isn't it? Because naturally you're going to go to 2018 because we won. And obviously the World Cup last year was incredible to make that final. You know, that was equally as special in many ways. But I think you look back on 2019 and 2022 as an incredible experience, but obviously not the results that we wanted, and a couple of very disappointing semi-finals. You know, we came away from those and everybody was completely flat and deflated. And naturally you will be after you've kind of gone in with such high hopes and being at home. But I think the takeaways, without a doubt, were the crowds and the interactions. I mean, in Liverpool, like, one of the things that we didn't plan for, and you know, in kind of my planning, that, and it's one thing that we've had to plan for since, is that we didn't expect the reaction of the public to be, the players to almost be like rock stars. And that they got to the point where if they went out the hotel, they had to like wear hoods up and caps and disguises, because if they just want to go and grab a quick coffee, they were literally getting hounded by people. So, and as great as that is, and you know, the players give so much time to fans and stuff, but when they need to grab a quick coffee before a training session, they don't always have a lot of time. So we found things like that quite challenging. But then also we had to harness that. Like on game day, what people started to realise is when they knew where we were staying, that they started to gather when they knew we'd be leaving for a game. And yeah. I remember the first couple of times we went out to the car park and literally we were getting mobbed by people and we couldn't drive off because we were worried about running people over. To the point we worked with the hotels and put barriers up all around the car park area so people could be at a good, safe distance. But then it created this incredible atmosphere. And I remember saying to the girls before the semi-final, like, just be ready for this. It's going to be a bit different to what you've experienced before, because I kind of seen it building. And we all met in the team room and walked down and it was incredible. Like the noise, there must have been a couple of thousand people outside the hotel. It was just fantastic. And You know, when they got in the cars, we were playing some music. I think it was Vindaloo we were playing. And the girls just said to me, like, we feel like rock stars. This is just crazy. So that reaction, that public support, and seeing the pictures of the fan parks looking like, you know, England were playing football in a World Cup final or something, were just stuff that you hadn't seen in netball, I guess. And I know I hadn't been around for that long, but that the girls were telling me that that just didn't happen before, or wasn't what they were used to. So that was quite special to be a part of, without a doubt. And the same with Birmingham, you know, the crowds there and the support we had was just phenomenal. Unfortunately, because of the COVID restrictions that were on, we didn't really get to interact with them in the same way. You know, we were kind of shut away in the village, and we couldn't really go out and engage with it so much. But it still felt pretty powerful when you got to Gamebend. You could hear the fan park outside the hotel and stuff. It was pretty special.
Just the growth of home fans, and over the past couple of years as well, at tournaments as well, but just in general, that's really nice to see as the sport moves forward.
Yeah, massively. Yeah, I think we've seen that grow, haven't we, to the point where we're outgrowing venues like the Copper Box now, which is really exciting. And obviously the recent Nations Cup, I'm thinking off the top of my head, we sold something like 15,000 tickets over the weekend, which was just phenomenal. And when you've got that kind of support, it feels incredible, you know, to have 8,000 people around a court screaming. It's great for the team, it's great for the players, and when the team's playing well, you know, you really feed off that as well. And there's been some great moments, and having that crowd behind it is just phenomenal as well. But it, you know, it wasn't like that when I started back in 2016. Yeah, I remember some of the games in Liverpool, we might have had like 1,500, 2,000 people there. And then to see it grow the way it's done, it's just been phenomenal. And I think even sometimes I would say we've had bigger crowds at home than we've had when we've been overseas, you know, with the exception of the Kudos that we played in Sydney when we had like 13,000. You know, most of the venues have only got 5,000 or 6,000 in Australia and New Zealand a lot of the time. So we seem to be playing to bigger crowds here, which is just fantastic.
Do you get to see as many NSL games as you'd like?
I try to, yeah, because I live in Worcester, so the Stars are on my doorstep. So I do try and get down to most of those games. I mean, as I said before, I have my own kind of racing commitments in these kind of months. So I do try and race on Sundays where I can. So if they can fit around my own getting away from netball, you know, part of my job is this
on
time
a quiet
is to
weekend. Yeah,
I do try and get away from it a little bit. But no, I always try and get to season opener, try and get to the grand final, and then try and get to as many sort of Stars games as I can, particularly really where our players are coming in. So if Stars are playing Loughborough or Manchester, or you know, the team sort of pulse where we've got most of our players, it's always quite nice to sort of go and show my face and then just have a little chat with some of the girls after the game and just to be around it, really. But I do enjoy it. I do enjoy going to the games and seeing the girls performing for their clubs. It's fun. And it's, do you know what I really like about it? Is walking in and sitting in the stands and having no responsibility whatsoever. That's quite a nice feeling on a match day.
And big plans for the league in 2025, NSL 2.0. Everybody needs to buy into this season and do what they can, buy an extra ticket, get along and really show their support.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I mean, yeah, showing up as the campaign's been and being there, but also watching it and engaging with it, like watching, downloading and watching the games on YouTube, whatever. Those figures are huge for us, because those are the figures that we present to broadcast, and we're trying to get broadcast deals, which are ultimately bringing money into the sport. So the more people watching and engaging with it, then the easier it is for us to sell it, you know, as a marketable thing, which is obviously what the objective is going forward, and to get more sponsors coming in to support the sport. And obviously that's going to, you know, if we can professionalise the league, which is the intention that we're working towards, then that's only going to push the standards up all around the clubs. And that's going to support us as a team without a doubt going forward. I mean, we've definitely seen that the benefits that we get from our players playing out in Australia and New Zealand in those professional leagues and what they bring back to our environment. So if we can get leagues on a par with those or better than those in the UK, then there's absolutely no doubt it's going to have an impact on the Roses and make us a better team going forward. So yeah, we'd certainly encourage everybody in, and that's why I try and play my part as much as I can as well. So watching NSL and trying to get along when I can, then it's all going to help, isn't it?
As we celebrate your 100 games and at the recent Nations Cup, it's not really about the number, is it? It's more about Jess, Sonia, Liana, and every one of the players, really, isn't it, over the years?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I mean, it was a nice, I have to say, for me, it's a nice little milestone to reach 100 games. Like, I never thought I'd get that far. So after the first two, I didn't think I'd get past three. So it's just nice to be, you know, to be in the sport for so long and to have seen so much. And when you get to 100, it's quite a special moment. It's quite a proud thing to do. And I think what makes it more special is the fact that the players and the staff make you feel special, which was just, it was overwhelming, to be honest. Like the support and stuff I had from the players and we got back to the hotel was just, yeah, it was quite emotional. And a lot of the players that I'd worked with over the years, but weren't with the team anymore. Ejivas, Layla's, Joe, Serena, Jade, Beth, for example, they'd all sent like really nice messages as well. So it was just, you know, it made you realize that you kind of had an impact and that people have appreciated working with you. And that was really quite special. So, but yeah, it's not about me. It's about the players. It's about the coaches. It's about us doing the best we can on court. But at the same time, yeah, it's always nice. It's a proud moment for me to have been around for so long and to be part of such a successful part of England netball history.
Paul, thank you for your time and good luck for the next 8 years.
yeah, we'll see. Maybe I'll still be here in 8 years' time. Who knows?
The Netball Show is now also available via Sky HD, Sky Q and Sky Glass. Select sport and we're on the podcast rail.